Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We talk this hour with Tommy Tomlinson, whose writing you most likely came to know in the Charlotte Observer, where he spent 23 years and was a finalist for the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for Commentary. You may have also read his stories in Esquire, ESPN the Magazine, Sports Illustrated, or Garden and Gun. Well, recently you've come to know Tommy's unique voice through his podcast for WFAE, Southbound. But this hour, we hear from Tommy about something incredibly personal, at times painfully so. But it's a story he decided to share about something he's dealt with his entire life, his weight. His new book, The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America, will be released tomorrow by Simon & Schuster, and Tommy joins us in advance to share what he calls the biggest story of his life. Welcome back.
Hey there, Mike.
Nice to see you. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch us on Facebook Live. And I want to remind people that there is a book release event tomorrow at Park Road Books from 7 to 8:30 p.m. with Tommy.
Yep.
Your struggle with weight has been lifelong. It has been painful. It's very, very personal. This book is it's one of the most personal accounts of a life I've ever read. We'll talk about that. Why did you feel you needed to write it?
It's the biggest story of my life, and it's the one story that I felt like I'd never been able to tell. The cliche among writers is write what you know. Well, this is the thing I've known more than anything else and had not before now been able to really make myself write it. As sort of a practical matter, what happened was I was in New York a few years ago, 7 years ago now, and I had breakfast with my book agent, somebody I'd been working with for 5 years at that point, trying to get a book out and not succeeding. And we had breakfast, and I got there before him, and he sat down and said, "So what have you been thinking about?" And so I decided to tell him exactly what I'd been thinking about at that moment, which was how I was going to fit in and sit at that particular diner where we were that morning. I Googled the interior the night before because there are so many trouble spots when a guy like me goes into a restaurant. If the table doesn't move, it's probably too tight. If the bar stools at the counter are bolted to the floor, I probably can't wedge in there. If the chairs have really narrow arms, it's difficult for me to have a place to sit. And as I'm telling him this, he just looks at me and goes, "Well, dude, that's your story. That's the book you ought to write." Yeah. And I agreed immediately, and then I didn't do it for 3 years because I was afraid to.
You write about that in your book,
yes.
That story. And correct me if I'm wrong, but is that the same account where you're riding the subway to this and you get there 15 minutes early to make sure that this will all work out for you? But in the course of writing or of riding the subway, you're standing up.
Yes, I am. I'm up, it's early morning rush hour in New York. The subways are crowded and I'm hanging onto the pole. And the whole time I'm thinking about, what happens if I fall? Because I'm from Charlotte. I haven't been to New York that much. I haven't rode the subway that much. I don't have that sort of rhythm of it that a lot of people have. And so I'm looking around me going, if I fall on this person, how much damage am I going to do to them? And there was an older woman sitting fairly close. And it's like, if I fall on her, I'm just going to crush her. And so that's the kind of stuff I think about, as I navigate my way through the world that I think other people maybe don't think about as much, and that's part of the reason.
Do you think you need to think about it, really?
I do. I mean, I've had situations where, I've stepped on somebody's foot, for example, and it's, when I step on somebody's foot, it's a lot more damage than somebody else stepping on somebody's foot. And I've, just like any other person, I've stumbled and fallen and been in people's way and crowds and that sort of thing. But when I do it, I carry so much weight around that it's a lot more potentially dangerous than it is for other people.
Let's talk about that, because you started this book. You start this book on New Year's Eve 2014, talking about New Year's Eve 2014, when you step on the scales and you look down, and there it says 460 pounds.
Yep.
460. Was it a surprise to you that day when you looked down at the scales?
Well, no. I knew, obviously, that I was vastly overweight, and I knew I was over 400 pounds. That particular number, I don't think I'd been that high before. Mm-hmm. And when it came down to actually write about all this, that was the hardest thing to write in the whole book, was just that number. Because I'd held that number, or whatever number I was weighing at the time. That was my most closely guarded secret. I didn't tell my wife that. Wow. I didn't tell my friends that. Nobody knew the number. Obviously, if you look at me, you know I'm a big guy. You know I'm overweight. But that number sets it in concrete in a way that sort of exemplified, I guess, the shame I felt about weighing that much.
Yeah, you, in the prologue, you write, "I weigh 460 pounds. Those are the hardest words I've ever had to write. Nobody knows that number, not my wife, not my doctor, not my closest friends. It feels like confessing a crime." You've lived with this, though, your whole life. This just didn't happen on New Year's Eve 2014.
No.
You've been overweight since you were a little boy.
Sure.
So why was it so this is something you've lived with and internalized and physicalized. Why was it so difficult?
It was difficult in that moment for a bigger reason. A few days before that New Year's Eve, in fact, on Christmas Eve, so a week before, my sister had died. Mm. My sister Brenda, who's an older sister,
right.
And she had died from complications from her own weight problems. And in that moment, as we went through her funeral, and I saw how my mom was devastated, and everybody around us was devastated by her death, I saw my future. As I write in the book, at the time, I was 50, I guess, and guys like me at that weight don't make it to 60. The actuarial tables are quickly turn against us. And so it felt the weight, for lack of a better word, of the size that I carried around and what it meant for me and the people who care about me was concentrated and just felt way more powerful and important in that moment than it ever had before.
I mean, at some point in our lives, we all face our own mortality. We all have a moment when we suddenly realize, for whatever reason, we're not going to be here forever.
Right.
It's going to end someday. So given that we all face that moment, what makes this moment for you that much harder?
Because I know that at this weight, my end is coming a lot sooner than it should.
Okay.
I don't know what the life expectancy of a normal American male is these days. I think 75, 80, something like that. The life expectancy for me would be 5 or 6 more years if I kept eating and kept getting bigger. You know, there's, as my doctor likes to say, the first symptom in about a third of heart patients is death. And so it comes up out of nowhere. And, you know, I'm on the watch list at the size, not necessarily my own blood tests or whatever, but diabetes, heart disease, several different types of cancer, all those things are exacerbated by being overweight. So I was slowly killing myself.
You go on, and I've talked about, I said this is one of the most personal accounts of a person's life I've ever read. I mean, you really I don't think you've held much back, if you've held anything back. You lay yourself bare, and knowing that this is going to be read by strangers.
They tell me they're going to print copies and actually sell them to people.
I'm holding one in my hand. I hate it. But strangers are going to read this. Worse, friends,
sure,
relatives are going to read this. And, I mean, you talk about things like standing in front of the mirror naked, and you graphically describe what that looks like. I mean, it's one thing to talk about what it's like to be overweight or what that does to your psyche, what it does to your life, what it does to relationships, how it's followed you through your life and what kids used to do when you were 10 or 11 and you were overweight and they weren't. But it's another thing to talk about those kinds of details, which are throughout this book. Why so graphic?
Well, I've read many, many books about people who've struggled with many things, you know, weight or addictions that they had or, you know, whatever struggle they had in their own lives. And I've read enough of those where I can immediately spot somebody who did not tell the story fairly. Or did not give enough of themselves so that I, as a reader, felt like I understood that person. And so my goal was to say, I'm going to lay it all out there so that you know what's in my head, what my body looks like, all those sorts of things. Because I think about what the purpose of this book is. And the purpose for me is for somebody else who's struggling with weight or whatever it is out there, I want them to know that what's in their head and the things that they're thinking about, somebody else is thinking the same thing.
Have you watched those shows on television where they profile truly, you're not anywhere near these people, but
my 600-pound life, yeah, and that's
exactly.
What I, yes.
And they try to get them out of bed, and they try to change their lives, and there's some doctor in Texas or Atlanta that puts them on this program. I've binged watched a couple of them because it's just so amazing that people can continue to live at that weight of 600, 700, 800 pounds.
Right.
But I never know how it ultimately ends for those people. Do they stick on that? Do you think? And then I think, well, maybe this is helpful. These TV shows are helpful to people who struggle with weight. Do you think they are? And B, you think this will be?
I'm deeply ambivalent about those shows because I think there is a little bit of a freak show aspect to
Absolutely.
It. I think for some people, they're very helpful. You know, in this book, I talk about The Biggest Loser. And in fact, interviewed a guy here in Charlotte, Sean Algaier, who was on The Biggest Loser. Mm-hmm. And he actually basically kicked himself off the show after a few weeks because he was doing so well. And he ended up losing 150-something pounds. But he has now gained it all back.
And he was like 430.
He was 440. He's right about the size that I was.
Okay.
And in many cases that happens. I think I mentioned in the book that the like most depressing Google search I can think of is gained all the weight back, because there's so many stories of that. And so one of the things I set out to do was to talk about not just the, you know, psychological parts of losing weight and all that, but how to kind of make a sustainable life so that when you lose weight, you can keep it off. And that, to me, for people who are really overweight like me, means not just the dieting part, but it means like understanding yourself better.
I don't know what your process is. I only know the outcome, and your writing has always been elegant. When you were a columnist for The Observer, you were the one thing I knew every time your column was out, I know I'm going to read this column.
No, thank you.
Because it was wonderful. Because of your writing, when you sat down to write this about yourself in such graphic, intimate detail, do you just let the words pour out and then go back and edit, and or do you do it in some other way? And when you sit down to edit and refine it, were you tempted to pull punches?
My process, I was talking to my wife, Alex Felsian, about this.
And you have 20 seconds.
I have 20 seconds. Well, other than that, so there was a lot of hard writing in the morning and napping in the afternoon because I was emotionally wrung out.
Well, we'll come back and talk about it. That's an unfair question to ask and then say, you have no time to answer. We'll come back and do that. Tommy Tomlinson's book is called The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. It comes out tomorrow. We'll continue in a moment on Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking Tommy Tomlinson, who does a podcast for us here at WFAE, among other things, called Southbound, which is a wonderful podcast. If you haven't listened to it, do, because not only is he a terrific writer, Tommy is a terrific interviewer. So you know what it's like to be on the other side of this.
Yeah, that's why I'm dreading it. Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't want to be on that side of it. Never. But I would certainly not want to write the intimate details of my life on paper and then sell it through Simon & Schuster, which means people will actually buy it. As you sat down to write this and you realized how frank you were being, how forthcoming you were being, did you take anything out? Did you amplify it because you didn't think it went far enough? Or did it just come flowing out the way you thought it needed to flow?
There were fits and starts with it where I had to think about whether to leave something. And as I thought about it, you know, the standard for me was, does this illustrate something meaningful? You know, there are a lot of gratuitous stories I could have told about being overweight that really didn't have a point to them. So I wanted everything to have a point, to have some meaning for the story I was trying to tell. So as I've told people, it's not really a tell-all, it's a tell-most, but there's not every single story about my life in there. But I did feel like when I wanted to illustrate a point, I needed to go ahead and tell, in a sense, kind of the raw version of it. Because, as I said before, I think people can spot a phony in these situations. And people who've certainly been overweight, have struggled with it in their lives, they could tell in a second whether I was giving of myself, trying to tell the full story or not. And I wanted people to be able to tell that I was being as authentic as possible as I was doing.
The impact of being fat has been severe. If I read the book correctly, and it goes well beyond the cruelty of childhood, where kids make fun of other kids for any number of reasons.
Sure.
Being fat, certainly one of them. What has it been like for you to have to carry this weight around, this burden around, which is more than a physical burden?
I think as a kid, I felt it mostly externally, like other kids making fun of me and that sort of thing. As I got older, I think I felt it more internally. Like when you're 55 like I am, you don't generally, people aren't like yelling at you on the street. But what I felt is this sort of immense shame and guilt inside me, because I feel like I've wasted so much of my life because there are things I can't do or haven't done because I've been overweight. Yeah. And so that is more, I felt like I'd been self-defeating in so many ways because of it. And so that's where it comes from now.
So here's how he writes that in the book, Tommy. He says, quote, "Being fat made me a kid who turned inward. Being fat made me stand out to people inclined to be cruel. Being fat made me think I'd never find love. Being fat made me doubt every good thing about myself. Being fat made me." And you go on to say that the past tense in that sentence is wrong. "I'm still fat," you say, "so it still makes me what I am." Which is harder, carrying the weight around or carrying that reality around?
Well, I think at this point it's carrying the reality around. I mean, the weight, I can find ways to move around in the world. You know, I can find accommodations. Sometimes it's difficult, as I described before, but I can get around the day and be fine. It's that that 20 minutes before I fall asleep at night, that's the trouble. You know, when I put my head down and I can't fall asleep right away, and I think about the things during the day that I didn't do or couldn't do and in my life because of all this, those sort of trouble moments are, I think, now the harder part for me.
There was a moment in the book, a line in the book that almost made me cry. You said that you never believed that you could do anything truly great because you failed so many times at the one crucial challenge in your life. And then you say, what the hell's wrong with me?
Man.
But you have achieved. I mean, you're a Pulitzer finalist.
Well,
you're a Nieman Fellow. You have podcasts and columns galore. You've written from some of the better publications in the country. You have this book out. How can you think that about yourself?
I think that's the insidious part about addiction or compulsion or whatever you want to call it, is that many people with these things can live successful lives on the other side of it. You know, I certainly feel like I've been professionally successful. I have a great wife I've been married to for 20 years. I have good friends, all that sort of thing. And that's what the question you asked before about what is the harder part. And that internal struggle for me, feeling like there's one big challenge in my life and I can't seem to face it. That for me, on my worst days, not every day, but in my worst days, that overwhelms everything else.
You've talked to a lot of people in various different walks of life, both as a person and as a journalist, getting a story and trying to tell that person's story. Do we all have that thing? I mean, in your case, it's weight. Do we all have that thing that makes us think, I'm never going to amount to anything, I'm not anything, I couldn't achieve anything because of this?
I do believe everybody has something. Certainly the degree of it is maybe higher or lower in some people. I have a chapter in my book that I call You Suck FM. And it's that voice in your head that's always telling you you're not good enough. Don't try this. You're going to fail. You'll never amount to anything. Something that stunned me over my career as a journalist, because as just the nature of my job, I've interviewed a lot of people who've been really successful in their careers.
Right.
How many people have that voice in their heads? And I think the degree to which you're able to deal with that voice and to mute it is a big indicator of how well you end up doing in life. I talked to Ron Green one time.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Green had been the Charlotte Observer sports columnist for 50 years, and he was retiring. And I said, Ron, I'm just so impressed with this. How'd you do it? And he said, every day I walked in and I thought I was going to get fired. And a guy who had been there 50 years, that sort of what I think is called imposter syndrome for a lot of people, that voice in his head had been there the whole time. He had made this towering career out of himself, but it was still there. And I think it's there for most of us.
But that's what makes him good. It's what drives him. It's what makes him careful about getting the story right and about finding a great way to tell the story. It's what makes you good.
Well, I agree with part of that. But, man, sometimes it just beats you up. Yeah, it beats the hell out of you, and it has for me.
No. The line after you write, what the hell is wrong with me, the next line in the book is, what the hell is wrong with us? Because we live in a growing America. In fact, it's in the title of your book, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. I think it's 40% of America is overweight. What is wrong with us?
Well, there's a combination of factors. Part of it is the just immense amount of advertising around fast food and junk food. You can't watch 5 minutes of commercial television without seeing an ad for McDonald's or Coke or Budweiser or something. And there's also this lingering feeling that food is like the last kind of communal experience that a lot of us have. You sit around the table and you eat a big meal and everybody's happy. Every time you see people sitting around eating a big meal at a movie or something like that, everybody's enjoying themselves. I think another factor, certainly in my case, has been so the move in our country, especially from sort of a blue collar society to a white collar society. My mom and dad worked in cotton fields in Georgia when they were growing up. When I was born, they were working in a seafood factory. They worked with their hands and backs every day, burned tons of calories. So they could go home at night and eat fried catfish, which we did many nights, and it made no difference in their weight. They were lean and strong. By the time I came along and I end up in a desk job, I'm eating that same diet that is culturally important and meaningful to my family, but I'm not burning it off the next day.
Yeah.
And I think that's happened to many, many people.
And you're right, having a conversation with your mother about something, probably you didn't know this, that she and your father would lie in bed at night and talk about your weight, how concerned they were about your weight. They never made the connection, did they? That they were feeding you buttermilk biscuits and fried catfish and fried chicken and that they could burn off.
Right. I think they probably knew it intellectually, but emotionally that's a really hard thing to separate from. My mom and dad grew up extremely poor.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing they had where they felt wealthy was food. They could put a really nice meal on the table and feel like they were eating as well as kings. And so by the time I came along, that was such an ingrained expression of love and wealth in our family and in so many other families that it's hard to pull away from that, even when you know it may have consequences.
Food is love. Food is a salve. As you mentioned, every commercial on television is about fast food. Every other commercial on television is about a drug.
Sure.
To cure what ails you, and what ails you is the food you ate in most cases. How much of it is that? How much of it is a lack of discipline? How much of it is just eating the wrong things because your parents fed you the wrong things? How much of it is just genetic? How many people walk around with all this extra weight and really don't overeat or even eat the wrong things? They just can't burn it off.
Science is muddled on this.
Yeah.
You know, for a
Why?
Lot.
Why? I mean, we know about we can send men to the moon. Why don't we know about this?
Because our bodies are the most complicated things in the universe. What works for you may not work for me, and vice versa. And even if you try different things that work for you, they may not work in the long term for you.
Right.
So our bodies are this incredibly complicated thing. One of the studies I talk about in the book was when they studied these guys, these contestants on The Biggest Loser. A lot of those people lost weight really fast. And when science had known for a while that when you lose a lot of weight, your metabolism slows down because your body is wanting to preserve the fat in you, because your body always thinks there's a hard winter coming up.
Right.
And you need to. Well, what they found out from studying these Biggest Loser contestants was even when you started to gain weight back, your body's metabolism was still slowing. And so that's just a heartbreaking thing to find out, that even if you're gaining weight back, your body still wants you to gain more. Basically, whatever weight you peaked at, that's what your body thinks you're supposed to be.
And this isn't your brain telling you this. This is just your internal cellular structure.
Right, this is like
self-survival.
This is the engine. This is how your body's engine works.
And do we think that that's set up at early childhood? In other words, if you'd eaten sushi as a child and no carbs and no fried foods, would you be having this problem today?
It's a good question. I think part of it for some people is set up, you know, in our DNA.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it's genetic. There are lots of people who walk around with 20 pounds more than what we consider to be normal, and even more than that, who are healthy and happy and living active lifestyles. They're fine. So, you know, leave those people alone. But I'm talking about people like me for whom this excess weight is dangerously unhealthy.
You use a word in the title of your book that has become a pejorative: fat. We don't call people fat today. We call them overweight.
Yep.
Doctors may call them morbidly obese. We have plus sizes and things like that.
Sure.
We don't call people fat. You're calling yourself that. Is saying that some kind of, is it difficult or is it the first step toward change?
It's both. I mean, it is difficult because I've always flinched at that word in the past. But I think it's an obvious descriptor, and I think it is sort of a reclaiming of that for me, as to say, yeah, I'm a fat guy, but here's how I'm trying to get better and to be a little bit less of that. And so I think the words do matter. It is sort of an in-the-family thing. Like, I feel like people who are overweight can say fat, and it's a little bit dicier when somebody who's not says it. But
is it like the N-word?
Certainly not on that scale. But it's something that I think people who aren't overweight need to be careful with.
Yeah. You talk about in the book about certain things you've never been able to do, and it seems to me that it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because you were overweight as a child, you couldn't climb trees, you never learned to swim, you couldn't pull yourself up on the monkey bars because
sure.
It's just too much weight for a young person's arms to do. If you can't do those things, then you become even more sedentary.
Yeah, there's certainly a cyclical aspect to it. That, and not only that, I think then there's sort of an internal cyclical thing too, where you feel kind of depressed or down about not being able to do those things. Mm-hmm. And so the way that many of us who are overweight counter that, those down feelings, is by having more food, because that's an endorphin. It's a quick hit that makes us feel better.
Yeah. And you learned early, because that you could use food as a way to get into social circles. You were, what, 5 years old, 4 years old?
Yeah, yeah.
And you stuck American processed cheese through the fence at other kids, and they came and got it.
That's my first real memory is I lived next door to a kindergarten.
Okay.
And I was too young, I think, to actually attend the kindergarten. But I was out in my yard one day, and these kids were there playing kickball. And I wanted them to play with me, but nobody would pay me any attention. So I went in the house, I got a slice of cheese, unwrapped it, folded it up so I could stick it through the fence, and I went over and kind of basically waved it at them. They came over to get the snack. They played ball with me, and so that food was this connection between us. And I've internalized that probably and lived with it ever since.
I mean, you couldn't do all those things because you were overweight, and people would make fun of you because you were overweight, particularly kids. And you talk about playing shirts and skins, and you always tried to be the shirt because you didn't want to take your shirt off. And you talk about that making you feel small. And I don't mean that, you mean by that, that it makes you feel bad.
And diminished.
And diminished.
Yes.
As a human being.
Sure. Well, it's the kind of thing, you know, when you're a kid especially, you just want to fit in.
Right.
And anybody who's an outlier feels small and diminished compared to the kind of the mainstream. And that was my outlier. Yeah. You know, I was the fat kid, and so people made a point of mocking me about it. And not all the time, but in certain circumstances and circles, especially, as you mentioned, like PE and that sort of thing. And I felt really tiny in those situations. I felt like I didn't have a good way to fight back or to push back against that. And so I felt diminished as a person, sure.
Tommy Tomlinson is our guest, longtime writer in Charlotte and around the country. His new book is called The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. He also does our Southbound podcast here at WFAE. We will continue our conversation. I'll share with you some things that have come in from listeners as they've been listening in a moment at Charlotte Talks.
If you've ever thought to yourself, I should make a podcast, now is your chance. WFAE is proud to present the Queen City PodQuest, the search for the next great podcast from Charlotte and the surrounding areas. Learn more and submit your idea by January 27th at wfae.org/Queen City PodQuest.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tommy Tomlinson is with us to talk about his book, The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America, which comes out tomorrow, published by Simon & Schuster, and there will be a book event tomorrow at Park Road Books from 7 to 8:30 for that. Let me share with you some things that have come in from listeners. Twitter comment. This is the first one that came in. Part of me wants to shake you for waiting so long, and part of me wants to hug you, cry, and say thank you for being brave enough to share your struggles.
You're allowed to do both.
Okay. Kathy on Twitter, you're brave and talented, and I thank you for giving voice to how so many of us live. This will hit a lot. 40% of Americans are overweight. This is going to hit a lot of people.
I was talking to somebody the other day, and I said, you know, I hope this book it reaches more than people who are overweight. And the guy said, well, dude, if you just hit those people, you'll be fine. You know, yeah, it is. It is a large and growing, not just literally, but demographically, part of our society.
Anna emails, I was a straight A student, president of every organization, it seemed, in school. And the only question I was ever asked by relatives was, how much weight have you lost recently? A lifelong issue, I weighed 100 pounds at 5. The feeling of you're never quite good enough continues to haunt me. I applaud your efforts. Did people ask you about your weight growing up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had an aunt who every time we would go see her, I'd get out of the car and she'd look at me and go, you ain't lost no weight. You know, because that was her assumption, that every time I left, I would go back and immediately try to lose weight. Now, she was sort of countering that by feeding me this giant Southern meal every time I got there, so she wasn't exactly helping. But yeah, I mean, I've had people ask me all the time, you know, throughout my life, you know, what are you doing, or what are you trying to do, or can I help, or here's this plan I have, or here's this thing that worked for me. Certainly since in the days leading up to publication of this book, I've heard from dozens of people who have their own ideas about how to do this and are reaching out along those lines.
Diane emails, I was born fat and remained obese until age 20. My weight has fluctuated since then, and I've always carried the extra 15 to 20 pounds of extra weight. I could stand to lose 15 pounds now, but no longer really struggle with it. But I very often think of how my life would be different had I not been obese for the first 20 years of my life. I did not go to college because I did not want to deal with peer ridicule. My one do-over wish would be to try my life again at a normal weight.
I think that's a very common feeling for people, that they missed out on so many things, or they didn't try so many things because they were afraid that they would be ridiculed, or they wouldn't be able to navigate, you know, a college campus or something like that. And so I've heard that over and over and over.
Your parents were not educated. No. I think one of your parents quit school at sixth grade or fourth grade.
My dad quit school in the sixth grade. My mom quit school in the fourth grade. They're very intelligent,
right?
Just not educated.
They're not book learning, but they're just smart about the world, and they know how to navigate the world, and they were smart about their lives and running a family. But you evidently excelled in school, and you found a way. When your father sat you down and said, we can't afford to send you to college, you said, well, there's these things called scholarships and Pell Grants.
Pell Grants. And, thank God for Pell Grants.
Yes, and that got you to what, UGA? Is that it?
University of Georgia, yeah.
Where you went to college. You didn't let this stop you. Why? And was part of your excelling in school a way to overcompensate?
Probably. I mean, I had not thought about it in that way, but I certainly had some drive to do something with myself on sort of the academic side. I felt like my mom and dad, even though they, as you said, they weren't educated, they traveled a tremendous distance in their life to get from sharecroppers in cotton fields in Georgia to get to basically a kind of a lower middle class workaday life in the seafood plant. And so they achieved this tremendous distance. And I thought, I want to try to achieve some kind of distance. I don't think I'll ever have to go as far as they got. But I wanted to achieve something. And I felt like eventually, it took a while for me to sort of land on this, but I felt like writing and storytelling was a place where I could do that.
There's probably a book in your parents' lives, because so many things about your parents' life are a lot of people of our generation,
sure,
had parents who were not educated. They were intelligent, they were smart about the world, but they weren't educated, and they came a long way from where they started to where they finished. There's probably a book in that.
Yeah, maybe so. I think, but the two things about my parents that I think about now, one, they were big readers. Mm-hmm. My dad read the Bible in the Bass Pro Shops catalog. My mom read romance novels by the truckload. Mm-hmm. And they were people of good character. They were decent people. Right. And I felt like I did inherit that.
Yeah. So we were talking about feeling small when you're in the public eye. And you talk about feeling small, but also having, you say, writing for anyone but yourself requires two skins. One has to be soft and porous to let the feelings of the story flow through you. The other has to be solid and flameproof to shield you from the blowback. Anybody who spent more than 5 minutes in broadcasting or newspapers or anything that requires your work to be consumed by the masses has to develop a pretty thick skin fairly quickly, or you don't last. Because otherwise, you get beaten to death by every single thing that people say. If you're on TV, they don't like what you wear. They don't like the color of your tie. They don't like your hair. They don't like the words you use on radio. They don't like what you wrote about or what your opinion was in your column. Which is harder, those kinds of criticisms or the fact that every once in a while growing up, some kid would call you fat or somebody would make a snide remark about you on the subway because you're overweight?
I don't know which one is harder. I think as I got older, I've been able to withstand it better. But also, people are more skilled in their cruelty as they get older, you know? And so the kinds of things that most of the time I can just brush this stuff off. But every once in a while, something will get to me. And I'll have to kind of, that's when I have to get up and take a deep breath and walk around the block or something and just, and kind of shake it off. But those are fairly rare now. The ones that, you know, when I write something or put something on the air, I know I'm going to get some blowback because anything you do that's good enough to be loved is also going to be hated. Somebody's going to wake up angry that morning and they're going to take it out on you. The ones that sort of come out of the blue, like I get blindsided by, those are the ones that I think affect me the most because I'm just walking around living my day and somebody will yell something or something. And those are the ones that kind of like bother me a little bit.
You know, we live in a society that is obsessed with body image. You go into the grocery store and stand at the checkout line and there's Men's Health or Glamour for women, and everybody in those magazines, and certainly everybody on the cover, is stunningly gorgeous, and they have the perfect body. You don't. I don't. But you but you don't. And I don't know that people think about what that does to you internally when you're surrounded by everything that is so beautiful in the world, and you don't think that you are. And you write. After you met the woman who would become your wife, you say that you couldn't understand how she could fall for you. All I could see, you write, was the disgusting man all those readers wrote about, because you talked about people writing about your weight when you wrote the column and your picture appeared in the paper next to your column. And you tell her, I'm damaged goods. Wow. I don't have a question for that.
Wow. Well, you know, that had been, you know, I dated in high school, college, and that sort of thing, but I always, in the back of my mind, I had this sort of bafflement because I could see myself in the mirror, and I'm like, well, why would somebody go out with me? Because of the way I look. And I've obviously, after 20 years of being married, have come to accept that my wife really loves me and she cares for me and that she accepts me the way I am and all those things. But I did kind of feel like, in some sense, once I knew that we were starting to fall for each other, I almost felt like I had to warn her that, you know, I don't know that you really understand in this moment what this means for us, that I might, the chances are that you are going to far outlive me and that that you're going to be potentially alone for a long time, and that there are things that you do now that maybe we're not going to be able to do together. And so, you know, I wanted to be upfront with her about those things because I didn't want us to get into a marriage where we didn't understand each other.
Again, you get very personal in this book about that relationship. I'm not going to go into it on the radio, but about that relationship, but what it's meant to you intimately, about what it's meant to her in terms of how she's had to adapt to you. How does she feel about you sharing all this?
I think there's some definite mixed feelings about it. Alex and I talked about this, you know, before I even started. And then in the writing, anytime, I mean, she read the whole book before, you know, publication, and as I was working on it. And then we talked pretty carefully about some of the key moments in there that she's involved in. And in fact, I interviewed her for the book. I wanted to sit down with her and turn the recorder on like I would with anybody else and just talk about our lives a little bit, because I think sometimes in that setting, you might say things that otherwise you wouldn't say, because now I'm saying, okay, well, tell me everything. And so I think it's been, on the whole, probably good for us that all this stuff is kind of on the table now in a way that it was maybe subsumed a little bit in the early years of our marriage, because she didn't know how to talk to me about this stuff, and I didn't know how to talk to her about it. And that's a very common thing, too, is that friends, family members, people who love you, they don't know how to, I mean, you could say, boy, you should lose weight, but that's not really helpful. You know, how do you talk to somebody about this? And I think the great thing about Alex is that she has nudged me in a very loving way to become a healthier and better person without me ever feeling like she was nagging me or on my case about it all the time. She is the key to all this for me.
Your mother read the book.
She did.
And she said?
She said two things. She said too many cuss words, which meant there was more than one or more than zero. And she said if she had known that I drank that much in college, she wouldn't have sent me any money.
She was sending you her tip money.
She was sending me her tip money.
She was a waitress.
She was a waitress. And she would send me, I'd get these envelopes of thick envelopes of $1 bills that was my spending money. I felt like I was always about to go to a strip club or something because I always had this big stack of ones in my wallet. But yeah, she sent me that money and I would often convert those $1 bills into beer.
You write about the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. Never heard of them, but maybe they're having an impact because fat shaming is no longer allowed in our society. But you write about their fighting to eliminate discrimination based on body size and about the response of industry to supply the needs of oversized adults, because now when theaters replace their seats, the seats are wider, and that's just because they don't want you to be comfortable. It's not because they want them to be wider. They're actually losing money because they're losing seats.
Sure.
It's to accommodate our growing population. There's plus sizes when you go to the stores, et cetera. Is all this helping, or is it enabling?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't really know where I come down on that yet. I think it is certainly day-to-day for me. It makes my life better to know that I can go to the movie theater and not be jammed into a seat. I don't know if enabling is the right word, but I do think there's this whole fat acceptance movement, which I, by and large, thoroughly agree with. Mm-hmm. Overweight people are discriminated against in the workplace. Many psychological and sociological studies have shown that. There are a lot of places, as you said, where sort of fat shaming, for lack of a better word, is still pretty prevalent in a lot of ways. And there are a lot of overweight people who live healthy and happy lives at their weight, and they should be fine to do that. What I worry about just a little is that people use that acceptance and these accommodations as an excuse to not confront the unhealthy nature of their weight. And those people who are unhealthy need a push in the other direction.
We have 2 minutes. You've had throat cancer, which is why your voice sounds the way it does. They went in and removed something from your larynx. I didn't know this until I read the book. You've had open heart surgery to remove a benign tumor.
Yeah, and nothing to do with my weight, but yeah, it was just a weird thing.
But you haven't had the gastric bypass surgery. Why not?
For me, I want. This is difficult because there are a lot of people who've had gastric bypass surgery, and I've heard from them as excerpts of the book have come out, and they're angry because I haven't tried it. For me, and I say just for me, it feels like a concession that I cannot handle this on my own. I know people who've had gastric bypass surgery, and it's worked really well for them. It's changed their life. I know other people who've had really terrible results from it, and it's made their lives worse in many ways, and then a lot of stuff in between. I want to try every other option available before I try that. It's still on the table for me if I can't long-term sustain, lose weight, but for now I'm holding off on it.
How are you doing? I mean, you weighed 460 pounds on New Year's Eve 2014.
I'm trying to be coy a little bit about it because in the book I sort of reveal the weight I've lost. I will say that I've lost weight. Mm-hmm. I want people to kind of read the book and not spoil it for them, but I've looked for a long-term sustainable way to do it, and so far I'm doing pretty well.
Maureen on Twitter, sitting in my car in the parking deck at work, listening when I should be heading in because I relate so much and need to compose myself. Imposter syndrome, the voice in your head, my head, so common, so human, so much a waste of our time. Keep writing, keep talking. Tommy Tomlinson, host of our Southbound podcast on WFAE. The book is The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.